have golf today. We'll like come in. It wouldn't necessarily be this height. We take our positions over here. Okay, and you would come around. Hello, nice to meet you. Hi, nice to meet you. Hello, nice to meet you.
Joseph.
Nice to meet you. Okay, we can be seated. Well, welcome. This is unit one, and we are here to hear the testimony that you have about the United States Constitution. And unit one's question is, what basic ideas about government did the founders have? Congress has formed a congressional committee. This committee will examine the United States Constitution and the purposes of government. The members of your group are expert witnesses who will appear before the committee. You've been asked to testify on the following questions. According to the founders, what are the basic purposes of government? Why did the framers think a constitution was necessary to achieve these purposes? Which did the founders think was more important, the common good or individual rights? And does our government still serve the purposes that the framers intended? You may begin.
When the men entrusted with guiding the Federation of Colonies that became our first states were considering how best to establish governance, they had many factors to consider. At its most basic level, the founders agreed that the purposes of government were to protect the rights of citizens to life, liberty, and property, and to make citizens feel safe and secure in their welfare. They also had to consider the delicate balance needed to preserve natural or preordained rights in the face of promoting the common good. Many of the founders subscribed to the theories purported by John Locke, who said that living in a state of nature without rules or laws would invariably prove detrimental for a society. Locke and the founders recognized that by agreeing to give up a measure of their freedom by establishing a government, these natural rights could better be protected.
To this end, they decided to draft a constitution which would provide the framework for the responsibilities of the government and enumerate the rights protected under law. Without a single defining document, the founders risked having the laws challenged or ignored. They also studied the governmental structure of the Roman Republic and chose it upon which to form our own democracy.
The people would be tasked with electing representatives who would in turn work with the government to ensure the common good of their constituency and the Republic as a whole. This system, despite some bumps in the road, has served us well for over 220 years. In summation, our founders recognized the need for structure to best serve the needs of the body politic. In drafting the Constitution, they ensured the rights of citizens would be protected in perpetuity.
Despite the noble aims of the founders, our government has been corrupted over time in ways that they likely could not have imagined. Pork barrel politics and other outside interests like lobbyists have resulted in rampant overspending. Certain leaders have used current events to suit the Certain leaders have used current events to justify the abolition of important rights. The Constitution was deliberately left vague in certain areas to allow for interpretation. But as a society, we need to take care that the common good is kept in mind at all times.
Okay, now we have some follow-up questions for you. What is a constitution?
Anybody can answer? A constitution is a document showing rules, laws, and regulations upon a government so that it limits the government's power over the people.
Okay. Anybody else have any?
It's a basic framework of ideas of how they thought our government should be put together and who should be covered underneath the Constitution.
Okay. Anything else?
No, they covered that one pretty well.
Okay. How is government different today than it was in the 1770s?
I think many problems exist, not necessarily problems, but just certain issues that exist today that weren't, that didn't exist then at that time. Problems that, issues that they didn't foresee, that they couldn't foresee. Different issues arising. We have a much different economy. We have a much different environment in which we live today, where large corporations rule the marketplace. It's getting harder and harder for small independent business owners to make their way in the economy. So you have a lot of rules and regulations that have changed over time as far as the practices of running businesses.
And as we had mentioned, the founding fathers recognized the fact that there were probably situations that they could not foresee. They did take care to provide provisions, or to ensure provisions, by making the Constitution as vague and as loose as possible, which would allow for interpretation through the judicial branch.
Unfortunately, a lot of different people see the Constitution in different ways, and therefore it needs to be more clear versus back in the 1700s when they all had the basic same framework or idea for the Constitution. Also, there were as many issues such as political monies exchanging hands. It makes the government a lot more shisty, I guess that's the word I'm looking for.
And they also provided the ability to add amendments to the Constitution so that policy could be changed in the future as need be.
In your opinion, what is more important, individual rights or the common good, and why?
I believe the common good is more important than individual rights. I believe just because I have the right to do something doesn't mean I can impose my rights on other people.
I disagree with that. I believe the individual rights are more important than the common good because I think the common public doesn't always know what's best for it. And I think by protecting the rights of individuals, I think that is what ultimately is going to be best for the common good. As we protect individuals' right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, property, these basic rights, these inalienable rights that we have, need to be protected at all costs. And I think that by doing that, we are promoting the common good at the same time.
However, when you break it down to the individual rights, people are often going to have opposing views in certain subjects. And therefore, it is the government or the Constitution's responsibility to look at the common good and say, okay, well, what is better for society as a whole? What is better for the people as a whole, not just this one individual person who may have a different opinion than all these other people?
And that's why, while we don't have a direct democracy, which would be almost impossible in a country with 300 million people, we do have a representative democracy in which the people do have a say in who will represent them, and they do have the ability to remove these elected officials at will. So the people are represented through their elected officials, and through that we're able to protect the individual rights as well as taking care of the common good.
Do you know who your representatives are?
Yes, ma'am.
Who are they?
Shelley Berkeley, John Porter, and Jim Gibbons.
Okay. Very good. Have there been times when individual rights and the common good were in conflict? Can you give an example?
I can give you an example that's actually ongoing right now with the Patriot Act legislation and the legislation that was actually just signed in last week that makes it a government policy that we are able to detain suspects indefinitely without providing access to counsel, which in effect overthrows the habeas corpus rights that we've had and which have only previously been tossed out during the Civil War. So it is a tumultuous time. There is legislation that is currently on the books that is taking away individual rights and disturbing the common good. So it is a time of change.
That's a whole smoking issue, okay. Where you look at it and you have to look at each individual's rights. It is my right to be able to walk outside or go to a restaurant or into a grocery store here in Las Vegas and be able to breathe without having to endure the hazardous effects of cigarette smoke. But it is also Suzanne's right to be able to go into establishments that allow, you know, smoking and to have a cigarette. And so at that point, the government has to look at it. We are both people. We are part of the common good, but we have two different views on what our rights should be. And so it's a very hard, when you look at question 4 and question 5 on the ballot, it's really hard to look at it. You know, Suzanne might want to vote no, I might want to vote yes. What is the common good overall?
To some extent, you have to play the devil's advocate on every issue when determining what is the common good. You have to be able to look at a viewpoint from both sides and establish what will protect the rights of the individual and what will also protect the rights of the common good or protect the common good itself. So.
I think you all did wonderful. You did better than wonderful for a group that's only been preparing for this for one day. You did a really, really good job. And my hats are off to you. You're ready. Very good.
Thank you.
Good participation.
Cool. So we can run for government now.
Good participation all the way around.
How did the framers write our Constitution? Congress has formed a congressional committee to gather information on the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights. It is also looking at the compromises that were made at the Philadelphia Convention. As expert witnesses, you will be asked to testify on the following questions. What major conflicts required the framers at the Philadelphia Convention to make compromises? Why was it so difficult for the framers to reach agreement about how to resolve their conflicts? How did the compromise of later adding a Bill of Rights affect our Constitution? Do you agree with the framers' decisions to keep the proceedings of the Philadelphia Convention secret? Why or why not? And was the group that assembled at the Philadelphia Convention a fair representation of people? Why or why not?
You may begin.
Ladies and gentlemen, our Constitution, our nation's supreme law of the land, if you will, was born out of a hot Philadelphia summer. The framers, 55 rich white men who gathered from every state except Rhode Island and didn't really represent the average American, chose to throw away the old Articles of Confederation and undergo a series of secret, intense debates and compromises to eventually emerge with a living Constitution. Compromise was a necessity during the Constitutional Convention. Each delegate showed up with preconceived ideas and notions for the new government. Two of these ideas were the Virginia Plan and the New Jersey Plan. The Virginia Plan called for representation of the new government to be based on population, with, of course, Virginia being the most populous state during the time. The New Jersey Plan simply called for representation to be equally distributed between the states. A compromise was reached between these two plans in what was simply called the Great Compromise, which resulted in our bicameral legislature, the upper house of our Congress, the Senate, being based on the New Jersey Plan, and the lower house, the House of Representatives, being based on the Virginia Plan. Another compromise that had to be reached, and much to our nation's shame, was called the Three-Fifths Compromise. Continuing with the issue of representation, great differences arose regarding who and who should not be counted towards the apportionment or the distribution of representatives. Northern states argued that if southern states were going to continue to have slavery, that their slaves should not be counted towards representation. Eventually, a compromise was reached during that long, hot summer in which every slave would be counted as 3/5 of a person. But the northern states got the southern states to agree that slavery would end in 1800. All of these compromises, of course, could not have been reached if they had not been ironed out and debated in complete secrecy.
Yes, I agree with the secrecy. First, it felt the need to speak freely. Second, if people told others what was said, they felt not as free to discuss their ideas and would be less likely to change their minds during the debate. Finally, they feared the people didn't want to accept the new Constitution if they knew all the disagreements present during the writing and would have a negative impact on the acceptance of the Constitution and ratification. In order for the Constitution to be ratified, it needed a Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791 and provided basic rights that would be protected under the federal government. It also proved the amendment process worked. Some of the basic rights provided in the first 10 amendments are the right to peacefully assemble, the freedom of speech, the freedom of press, the protection against unlawful searches and seizures, the right to a speedy and public trial by a jury with representation. The Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, provided a comprehensive document that allowed for interpretation for over 200 years. This living document has and will continue to stand the test of time.
Okay, thank you. We have some follow-up questions for you. Why did the framers not abolish slavery at the time they wrote the Constitution?
One possible explanation would be that they were trying to keep the Union together. Under the Articles, every state was like its own little independent country, able to print its own currency. And so in order to keep both slave states and free states together, you might say the northern states simply wimped out, went along with the southern states, and allowed for slavery.
Okay. Anybody else?
Okay. 55 men attended the Philadelphia Convention. Do you think the Constitution would be different if the representatives had been women, and how might it be different?
If women had been a part of it, it would have been different, and women would have been given the rights that they were later given at the time of the original writing of the Constitution.
Do you think that they would have, sure, we can speculate, but you think that they would have, that there would have been as much intellectual struggle as the framers had women been part of the Constitutional Convention? Do you think it would have been an easier process or more difficult?
I think it would have been more difficult because there would have been opposing viewpoints, even more so if there would have been, because women didn't have the rights that men had, so they would have been, there would have been a struggle there just for women to get their foot in the door and to be given rights that they didn't have.
Such as voting, which wasn't resolved until 1920 with the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm.
I heard you all mention that about the secrecy of the Constitutional Congress, and I believe I heard someone say that was a good thing, that it was in secret. Elaborate a little bit more for me about why you think that was a good plan, or what would have been different had it been an open proceeding.
Okay, because the people, didn't want influence outside of what they were trying to get resolved. It's just like if you hear someone say something about someone that they don't like, and you've never met that person, or you don't know the details about that person, you don't know their attitudes, you don't know anything about them, and then now you have this preconceived idea that this person is this way when they're actually not. And so they just wanted to make sure that whatever was going on between them, that before they give it to everyone else, that all the kinks, you may say, are ironed out. And that it, when it's represented or presented, it's everyone can base their own opinions on what is being said, not influenced by others.
Do you think that if there was a secret constitutional convention or something along that lines taking place today, that it would fly, that it would actually be able to take place, that our government leaders could meet in secrecy to develop such a document? Do you think it's possible? Probable? Do you think it could happen?
I would say no. I'd say the story get out and some of the note points would get leaked. Either someone would get bought off or somebody would have a bug inside or a mole. Something would get out. I mean, even the framers, they had to keep eyes on each other. I mean, Ben Franklin was at the convention. He was in his 80s. He was a drunk old man. And they had to assign somebody every night to go with him so that he didn't blab when he started drinking. It was hard for them to do it in 1787, and it would be incredibly impossible today.
What can you learn about a country's government by studying its constitution? What do you think you can learn by studying the constitution? If people in other countries are looking at our constitution, what do you think it says about us?
If people of other countries are looking at our constitution, mm-hmm. that they value our government, our system of government, and that they look at us because our government values our citizens and or more, values our citizenship more than some other countries that don't have, that we're citizens don't have the same rights as we do. So we're an example.
Anybody else?
Our Constitution really reflects values of the Enlightenment, of individual supremacy, of protections from government, of limited government, of separation of powers. And all these key ideas, these big principles, are all right there in the very basic document, our living document that has lasted 219 years so far and keeps mm-hmm. going like the Energizer Bunny.
We heard you were in the room and the previous unit was talking about what's best for all. People sometimes disagree about what is best for all in the community. Describe a situation where this might happen, and what do you think such disagreements, or how do you think such disagreements should be settled?
I'll take that one. Actually, it's almost like in education when you're in a classroom. If you have a student with special needs who might have to have a ball in their hand to keep on task, everyone in that room doesn't need a ball in their hand to stay on task, but that person do. So for that person in particular, that person in particular, it's not fair. Well, everyone would think it's not fair, but fair is for what that person needs. And it's fair for that student to have that because that person needs that. And I'm sorry, that ring just totally
okay.
lost my
okay.
Never mind.
Anybody else want to?
We'll lynch the person later.
All right. Well, we'll call time. Another wonderful thing.
The question is, how does the Constitution organize our government? Congress has formed a congressional committee to look at how power is divided among the three branches of our national government. As expert witnesses, you will be asked to testify on the following questions. How did the framers use separation of powers and checks and balances to limit the powers of government? Give examples of checks and balances at work today. Give examples of the use of federalism to limit power. Do you think the Congress should have the power to pass a bill over the president's veto? Why or why not? And do you think the Supreme Court should have the power to declare a law passed by Congress unconstitutional? Why or why not?
You may begin.
Well, the framers of the Constitution were, although they saw the need for a strong government, they were also very fearful of a government that could become too strong. And they had plenty of recent examples in the struggle with the king and parliament in England. And so they devised a plan where they came up with three branches of government and then chose to distribute the powers between the three and almost to create some competition between them, but also to almost cripple each branch so that not one branch could acquire too much power, and even stopped two branches from together putting it together enough power to become too powerful. So they came up with a legislative branch which would enact the laws and raise money for the government, but they didn't give them the power to enforce the laws. They created the executive branch to enforce the laws, but without any power to actually enact the laws by itself or to raise money. And then they created the judicial branch to interpret whether the laws that were passed by the legislative or executive branches together were even constitutional, and to basically judge the law. And then in terms of some of the checks and balances that they put in to limit power, in the legislative branch they actually have two houses of representatives, the Senate and the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives, because they have the shortest terms, and at the time of enacting the Constitution, they were the only elected officials who were actually elected by the people. They gave them the power to raise money and to vote a bill to spend money, so that if the people were unhappy, they only had to wait 2 years to throw them out of office. So the House can pass a spending bill, but they need the Senate to concur with whatever it is that they want to pass to make the bill, and then it still requires the executive branch to sign off on it to make it a law. The Senate can approve appointments and treaties, but they can't make the appointments or they can't negotiate the treaties. The executive can negotiate the treaties and make the appointments, but they need the Senate to approve them. So neither has sole power there. And again, like I said earlier, the judicial has the judicial review on constitutionality. Some examples today of that separation of powers, probably the Supreme Court nominations that we just had about a year ago, where the president nominated his candidates for the Supreme Court. One of them didn't even get to a vote in the Senate, but the other did actually need the Senate confirmation. So I'm passing it off.
As far as giving the example of the checks and balances, I wish I had actually come up with an example of checks and balances. I think that the mere fact that I can't come up with an example shows the mere importance that we need to have a system of checks and balances. For the most part, over the last 6 years, this president's had free reign. Anything that he has wanted, he has gotten. And without going into too many specifics to offend people, I think we see the end result of that. So I think that in itself, without me being able to show you a specific example of checks and balances, I think we can see, based on the lack of seeing it, the importance of it. So we'll next talk about federalism. And with federalism, my understanding of the definition of federalism is the sharing of power between state and local governments. And federalism is a good thing. Now, if we look at it from the perspective of, as Joe stated, about the federal government having too much power, if we look back at the early days of our country, we first start with our new Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, there was a definite lack of the sharing of that power. What we had was a confederation, a series of smaller governments who controlled the larger governments, and that kind of tied the federal government's hands. It couldn't do a series of things. You had all the states printing their own money. Each one had their own little state militia. Inflation was running rampant throughout the 13 states at that time. So when we got our new government, our new federal system put into place, there was a focus on giving that government more power. So federalism from that perspective, I don't necessarily know that there needs to be a limit. I mean, we can see specific examples of federalism with taxes,
what money is going to be used, designated for what within the states. But for the most part, I think if I had to talk about federalism, I would say it's probably a good thing. I'll go ahead and defer.
Okay, and do you think Congress should have the power to pass a bill over the president's veto? I would strongly say yes, because if they didn't have that power, then the president would be nothing more than a common dictator. And history has shown that in the past that dictators abuse their power and take advantage of the people. So with Congress being able to pass a bill over the president's veto, it gives a sort of balance to the president's power. So it puts stipulations on him so he doesn't have complete and total power. And do you think the Supreme Court should have power to declare a law passed by Congress unconstitutional? I would also have to say yes, because the only thing you would need would be the president and one-third of Congress to vote any law down that they didn't want. So, for example, with Roe versus Wade, where citizen rights were given to African Americans, they came out with the Jim Crow laws, which were the separate but equal laws, which were they interpret what the bill said and use it to the people's disadvantage. And I guess that's it.
Okay, all right, we have some questions for you. What keeps the president from becoming too powerful?
Well, as I've already stated, I kind of think that we're seeing a little bit of a lack of that. I think you need to have a little bit of bipartisanship in both houses, both the Senate and the House of Representatives. And right now, we're just not seeing. I think he's only had one bill vetoed since he's been in office, and if I'm not mistaken, it was the one on stem cell research, which is, I think, something that most people in the general population are in favor of. The good thing is this, hopefully if they make too many mistakes, maybe at some point the Supreme Court could maybe step in and take a look at some of these.
Theory, though, Congress is the check on a president's power, and the justice system is a check on the president's power. Of course, in the days that they wrote the Constitution, they didn't have political parties, and so the president didn't also serve as the head of a political party, which is what Zach is talking about. So
I also think one good thing about that has shown recently is that, like with Bill Clinton, where when the Monica Lewinsky trial, where they would eventually, you know, vote to kick him out if they thought that he was abusing his power. So I do think that recently there is something that shows that there is still checks and balances in our system, or else they would have never, where they would impeach Bill Clinton if they didn't think he was doing his job correctly. And they also did with President Johnson as well.
There are people who think that the presidency is becoming way too powerful.
Because there's no check.
Well, because when they changed from the president being popularly elected versus being not, then they gave the president the power to go around the political parties and go around those leaders directly to the people. And you do have a situation there. Well, he could become a demigod become too powerful.
So it's supposed to be that the president was just the speaker of the people, that he was voted in just as the voice for America, and where Congress was the real power behind our government. But recently it just shows that he has a lot more say. So where you have these elections that just talk about, you know, who's going to be president, or how big, you know, how close election it is, where it shouldn't even really matter who the president is. He's just the voice, where the real power is behind Congress, and that's where the real focus should be centered at.
Well, what are the powers of the president, and which power do you think is most important, and why?
Okay, the president has the power to veto Congress if he feels that a law is unconstitutional, and the president also
negotiates treaties, makes appointments, appoints ambassadors.
I kind of see his job as to handle relations with foreign nations. I kind of see that as, even though we have a Secretary of State that kind of helps him deal with that, I do see that as his primary job. To me, that's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to handle relations and go out and communicate with people if there's a crisis and deal with that crisis. North Korea would be a good example. Iraq would be a good example. Iran would be a good example. I mean, to go out and reach out to those countries to keep future problems and future presidencies from having to deal with them.
Whatever Congress, what he enforces the law. So whatever Congress agrees that what should be law, he is basically the speakerhead and enforces the law and tells the people what the law is and how it's going to happen.
How do cases get to the Supreme Court?
My understanding of how cases get to the Supreme Court is there's a law that's been passed that someone feels that it's infringed upon their rights under the Constitution. So they can challenge that law at the state level. Then once again, it can go on appeal, depending on what the ruling is, to the federal level, work its way through the circuit court, and eventually work its way to the Supreme Court, where you can get a final judgment on the issue.
If the Supreme Court chooses to hear the case.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, we'll call time. We can say... Very good. Nice presentation. Looks like that was a look of relief there. All right, next unit, Unit 4. Unit 4, we're here to hear your testimony on the following question. How does the Constitution protect our basic rights? What is freedom of expression and why is it important to our democracy? How does the Constitution protect freedom of expression? Are there times when freedom of expression should be limited? Why or why not? And give examples. How is freedom of religion protected in the Constitution? When is it acceptable for government to limit the practice of people's religious beliefs? And how has the idea of equal protection of the laws been used to protect people's rights? Give examples. You may begin.
The Constitution, as originally drafted by our nation's founders, addressed the formation and functions of our governmental bodies. However, as it was written, the document did nothing to ensure that the basic rights of the people were well protected. A reference for this is the case of John Buckner in Virginia in 1682. He owned a printing press and he printed up the established laws for his colony, which drew the ire of the colony's governor, at which point Buckner was persecuted and printing presses were outlawed in the colony because the governor did not want the dissemination of that information to the people. For that reason and reasons like it, the Bill of Rights, comprised of the first 10 amendments, were added to the Constitution to protect the inherent rights of individuals within our society to live freely without fear of governmental oppression. Later, the protections provided at the national level were extended to individuals at the state level through the passage of the 14th Amendment as outlined in Section 1 of said amendment.
The freedom of expression promotes individual growth and human dignity, is important for the advancement of knowledge, is a necessary part of our representative government, is vital to bringing about peaceful social change, is essential for the protection of all individual rights, and should only be limited when it infringes upon the rights of other individuals or when it infringes on our constitutional authority of government officials to carry out their duties. For example, you may not shout fire in a crowded theater just to frighten people when there is no fire.
Freedom of religion is another basic right protected for the people by the Bill of Rights. This right is so important it was made the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights. It ensures through the First Amendment the Establishment Clause, which states that there should be no official national religion, as there was in Great Britain at the time. The other part to this amendment is the Free Exercise Clause, protecting that individuals may choose any or no religion according to their own beliefs. Our freedom of religion shall only be limited when it is not for the common good or when religious practices become harmful to the public.
This issue becomes very controversial, especially some cases concerning children, such as vaccination for students going into school. Some places actually allow the students to be admitted to schools without having their shots.
Prior to the clarification of the 14th Amendment in the Brown versus the Board of Education, individuals' rights were not protected in court against the state. The Equal Protection Clause, as stated in the 14th Amendment and upheld by Supreme Court Judge Thurgood Marshall, granted equal access to the benefits of the Bill of Rights regardless of race, ethnicity, disability, age, and gender. Some examples of movements or groups that followed this change are civil rights movement, women's movement, Native Americans, Latinos, people with disabilities, and others. The Constitution has changed over time, ever reflecting and being redefined by society's current issues. Our government responded to the need for individuals' equal protection, supporting individual rights by recognizing each citizen's fair access to all the Bill of Rights affords.
Okay, we have some follow-up questions for you. The Bill of Rights does not guarantee rights for all of the people, for example, women and African Americans. How was this corrected?
May I? Please. With the 14th Amendment, this, instead of, I think, from what I remember, states had protection against the government with the Bill of Rights. Individuals did not. The 14th Amendment afforded individuals' rights against the state, and they would be ensured to be protected by the federal government.
And just over time, additional amendments were passed because the Constitution is a living document, as needs were recognized and movements made and change affected. Different amendments were passed to allow, for example, women's suffrage, the right to vote of children of, well, I guess they would be considered adults. The establishment of 18, I guess, as the age of authority or the age of majority for children, giving them the right to vote. So that also allowed for, I lost my train of thought.
Suppose a small group of people in an audience get angry with a speaker and try to stop a person from speaking. Whose rights should the police protect?
The police should absolutely protect the speaker from being harmed in any way, because I do have the freedom of speech and expression.
Anybody else?
I'm sorry, did they ask if they were just screaming in that area? Is that what the question was? Were they?
It just says that they were angry.
That they were angry? I don't know. I mean, I agree with her saying that they should respect the rights, because she does have the freedom of speech if they're angry. A lot of times I think that they just try to move the person out of the situation with other people around, making it not so public so that that person has a chance to calm down and so that it doesn't get to a point where it's violent or harmful to other people around.
What if the speech relates to hateful messages?
Well, then at that point, I think it needs to be determined whether the person who is angry, if their rights are infringing upon other people's rights, because your rights are only limited as far as you reach. If you begin to infringe upon somebody else's rights, then you no longer have cause for those actions.
Is it constitutional for a group of people to stage a protest on the front lawn of your home without your permission? Why or why not?
Go ahead. Did you want to go?
In my opinion, I think it would not be if the protest actually takes place on your personal property, because you do have the right to, I suppose, the privacy of your property. However, if that protest against you, I'm presuming, took place in a public area, I believe that they would be within their constitutional rights to protest. If it took place in the street right beyond your lawn, I think that they would be justified and protected.
As long as it wasn't disrupting the peace. Or
yes.
Mm-hmm. The common good of the neighborhood or mm-hmm. your surrounding areas.
What are the benefits of freedom of expression?
And the costs.
What are the benefits and the costs of freedom of expression?
One of the benefits of freedom of expression is that it helps us learn how to make good decisions by listening to other people's opinions and basically sort of forming our own from that. Just basically the more information we know, the better.
There are many societies out there where you don't have the freedom to express what you feel or think, the opinions that you have, and I think that stifles a lot of people and breeds anger, hate, violence in some cases. I think that's definitely a privilege that we should take advantage of.
And everybody's opinion is different, so you could definitely keep that in mind when you're talking about something, because it may be something that I've never thought of and I didn't realize maybe I was hurting her feelings or just something like that. So that
you can always learn though as well, even if you disagree. Even this exercise, people may disagree, but we're learning. I don't think in some societies you probably don't have that opportunity. So
no, I'm sorry. It also makes for a more informed electorate. You are given access to knowledge about who's running your government, how your government is being run, what is and is not working. You're given an opportunity to form an opinion and to hear and grow from the opinions of others, so that when you do go and participate in representative democracy, it's not just, well, theoretically, it's not just checking boxes based on names you recognize, but you are actually decision making.
Do you perceive any costs?
I think Tiffany mentioned that you could always hurt someone's feelings by disagreeing with them, or I know there are a lot of hurtful things, especially on the internet nowadays, that and through media, slander, and except for slander's not allowed, but there are a lot of ways that I think people can be hurt emotionally.
I agree with that. There's a lot of speech that is not necessarily peaceful or peaceable speech, but it is still protected speech. And especially with the advanced technology that we do enjoy today, it's far more widespread than it would have been in the past. So people who don't necessarily have, I guess, the nicest things to say are at liberty to say it and to spread it as far and as wide as they're able.
Some schools have dress codes or wear uniforms. Do you think that requiring students to wear uniforms is a violation of their freedom of expression?
No.
Perhaps I'm weighing in as a mom, but I don't necessarily believe that children have identified right to that freedom. I guess their freedom extends as far as their parents allow, and I believe that the school, as a public place, I think that the interest of the common good would prevail over any individual rights of students, of their families and their personal preferences. I think that if my kids all attend schools where there are either uniforms or standard student attire, and that was one of my reasons for favoring it, the school community and the good of the school community, in my opinion, takes precedence over expression. There are far more ways to express yourself, I believe, in school than what you put on.
I agree. I entirely agree with that. I think they just take away from a lot of the, either way you're going to have people who have their cliques and have their preferences as far as friends and people they're around. However, school uniforms make it so you're there to learn, you're not there to show off what clothes you have on that day, you're not there. You know, as far as freedom of expression is, you can always go home and change your clothes when you're out, hanging out with your friends and going out into public places other than the school setting. I mean, it's a very easy to just say no, you should be able to express yourself in school, it's the most important place, but at the same time, it focuses on them expressing themselves in other ways other than their clothes and with their words and with their school academics instead of
a more positive
reinforcement in the school.
Great. We'll call time.
Very nice. It's like scary with you sitting right there. You're
like, I know, he's like,
and I'm like writing.
He's all closed.
He's like, and it's also
he moves the little iPod around
for the kids because, as you know, growing up, you know,
I don't know if I'm supposed to do anything with that.
Okay, this is unit 5.
What are the responsibilities of citizens? Congress has formed a congressional committee to examine the responsibilities of citizens in our constitutional democracy. As expert witnesses, you will be asked to testify on the following questions. What responsibilities go along with the rights of citizens? Do you think every citizen should be required to participate in his or her government, and why? How does a responsible citizen promote the common good? Why do so many young people not fulfill their responsibility to vote? And as citizens of a democracy, do we have responsibilities to other nations of the world?
Okay, well, Thomas Jefferson and our founders felt that all people should have an opportunity to get an education. Thomas Jefferson stated that if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. Our framers planned our government so that its powers were limited and balanced among the three branches, the executive, judicial, and legislative branches. Our Constitution gives us natural rights of life, liberty, and property. It also gives the citizens the right to freedom of expression, religion, equal protection of the law, due process, and the right to vote and run for office. All citizens, as citizens, it is our responsibility to protect our natural rights. It is our duty to serve the common good and to be informed, responsible citizens so that we can work cooperatively with our government to protect all the people.
Okay. One of the reasons why many young people do not feel their responsibility to vote is because they don't see a connection between government policies and concerns of their individual lives. This could be because they're just not informed, and I think it's the responsibility of our educators to help with that. And as a nation, we should be a reflection of good citizens to other countries. We need to respect each other's differences and work to promote good relations between ourselves and other nations while protecting the freedoms we enjoy. Being good humanitarians, fair with trade and diplomacy, honest in our treaties and agreements, and our military force.
Anything else? Mm-hmm. We are granted certain rights as citizens of a democracy, and with these rights come responsibilities. For example, with our right to freedom of expression, we have responsibilities concerning the manner in which an individual speaks and what is said. And we have a responsibility to the awareness of others' rights to speak. And we also, in our awareness of others' rights to speak, is also a tolerance of their different points of view. And in regarding our rights to freedom of religion, we have a responsibility the way that we practice our religious beliefs. And we also have a responsibility to be aware of others' rights to practice their religious beliefs. And the right to equal protection of the law. It's each citizen's individual responsibility to ensure that they are treated fairly regardless of age, gender, race, or religion. We also have a right to due process, and with that comes a responsibility to press charges against anyone who has violated their individual rights, and it is accused has a responsibility to prove their innocence. The right to vote and run for public office. We as citizens have the responsibility to be informed voters. We have the responsibility to learn about our government, what it is supposed to do, how it works, and what rights citizens have. We have the responsibility to stay informed about what our government is doing, and we can do this by reading newspapers, magazines, and getting information over the internet, listening to news on the radio and television, and discussing actions of our government with our family and friends, which is very important. We also have the responsibility to protect individual rights and the rights of others, to express our opinions, and to write to our government officials. And we also have the responsibility to volunteer in our communities to help people. And we also, most importantly, have the responsibility to start now to be an informed and effective citizen.
Aside from the We the People program, are schools doing enough to educate voters, and what more could be done?
I don't think that the schools are doing enough. I think just as being a mom of teenagers, they really don't know. And I think it's just a census of them and their friends. They don't really know what's going on. They're angry about a lot of things and about a lot of rules, but they don't know why they're there. And I think as educators, it's our duty to bring newspapers into the classroom, bring them current events so that they can look at and make their own decisions.
And make connections. Mm-hmm.
What do you think citizens can do to change a law that they think is unfair?
They have to express their opinions openly, and they need to write letters to the members of their local and federal government.
Anybody else?
And organize. What kind of protests are those?
Oh, peaceful.
Peaceful
that
protests.
Usually ends up not peaceful.
Yeah.
I think it's all a matter of electing, having a educated decision when you elect the officials going into office, to know that they are there for what you believe in.
Yes, it's important that students, especially the teenagers that are coming of age to be able to vote, to know what their rights are so that they can look at the issues that are and not just go by what maybe a family member says or a friend says is the right thing to do. They need to be informed and understand why they're voting for that person, not just because somebody else is voting for them. And I think that that might be a big mistake too with the younger people if they're not educated mm-hmm. properly in the schools.
Some people have suggested that in the future, citizens would be allowed to vote on their home computers. What are your opinions about this idea?
I think it takes away from the whole experience of going down to the center where they're holding the voting and going in, and it's a different experience. It's bigger than you when you go down there and participate in that kind of an activity. You know, it has its whole experience. And for me to do it in your house voting, it takes away the whole experience, the whole thing of you stepping out of your life and how you run your activities day to day and going out of your way to be a member of society and to do your duty as a citizen.
I agree with her, but I disagree in a way, because I think there's a lot of people that use time as an issue for not being able to vote, and I think that if they had access to that, or maybe somebody has a disability that cannot get down there, not someone to take them down there to vote, that easy access, and everyone has a chance. They have a chance to vote. So I think it's a good idea, as long as it's as a protected site and there's no tampering or anything, because the internet's very scary these days. So.
As a fairly new resident to Nevada, I was surprised to see that there was what is called early voting. Do you think that this is a practice that should be adopted around the country to get more people to vote? Do you think it should be abolished? Is it useful or not useful, do you think?
I have a couple of views on that. For early voting, I can see where it's good for some people, maybe people who have trouble getting around, they can do it earlier, they can avoid the crowds. But also, on another point, there's so much that can happen from the time that you cast your early vote to when the election voting, you know, the deadline takes place, that you may want to change your view by the time it comes around, because things can happen from those two points. And I wonder if early voting is even a good idea in that respect. But I can see the convenience of it also. So I myself do not do the early voting.
I do. I think it's important to have early voting. I think if you're getting ready to vote, I think you should know already, you know, where your views lie. And one thing on TV that comes up is not going to sway my decision. And I think it's really important that people have an opportunity to not have to go with all the crowds. They may not be able to go. They're at work, they're at school, whatever the case may be. They have a chance to go on their own. So I like it.
I agree.
Which one?
Johnny.
The latter.
You mentioned lots of responsibilities of citizens. So what are the most important responsibilities of citizens in our democracy?
To obey the law.
Obey the law.
I think the right to vote is very important. The right to hold office, and well, what she said, to obey the laws, and the freedom of religion, freedom of expression. I think they're all equal. When you come down to, you can find points with everything.
I think we're very fortunate in our country to be able to have certain freedoms that other countries don't have, but I think we should respect those rights and to obey the laws, because that's what gives us our power and our freedom and our power as people to be able to make decisions in voting and everything where other people don't have that. So I think we're very fortunate. We should follow our laws.
Do you think the current voting age is appropriate? Should the age be raised or lowered? And tell me why.
I believe it's appropriate, 18, because I've seen a lot of the citizens now that are 18 years old. I've seen an increased awareness and responsibility in their demeanor, especially the MTV generation. And they seem to be a lot more involved and a lot more politically aware. So I believe that 18 at this point in time is an appropriate age for voting.
I agree. And especially now, especially with programs like this in our school that just help so much to understand government more than any other programs that even when I was going to school, you know, in elementary school and junior high and high school, I think this helps you understand more your rights as a citizen, and you're able to make better decisions because of programs like this.
So. On that note, I'll call time and say, good job.
Watch your toes.
All right, now, everybody, give yourselves
Can we breathe now?
Round of applause. Very good.